Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So hey everybody, welcome to episode 193 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitra and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And I'm also joined by Mark Rubin down there in San Jose, California. Hello. Home of WWDC. All right. So we have some Ask MTJC. Jaime, have you had a look at these yet?
Yes, I have them up right now. All right. Let's see, the first one is from Greg, and that is not Greg Hio, which is what I thought at first. This is at Boy With Axe, who says, first off, great podcast. Love all the tips and picks you always provide. Do you guys use the new advanced animations with UI kit? And if so, do you have any pointers in general best practices for use?
I haven't looked at that yet.
Well, let's first of all convene on what exactly is he talking about. Is it like the property animator stuff for core animation? Or is it something else that it could be that I'm mistaking it for?
I'm guessing you mean it's property animators that came out last year.
Was it? Yeah. Because we've had UI dynamics and that kind of stuff for many, many years.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So I'm also a little embarrassed to say that I have not used them yet. I haven't really even looked at them yet. I guess now it's on my short list of things to do.
Yep.
So for me, I hope I'm not dreaming this, but I was involved in a code review for some code that happened to involve it property animator, I think. I'm pretty sure it did. It definitely needs to go on my list of things to dig out of the archive, watch that session from, I think it's last year's WWDC, and take a look at that. But I kind of remember it looking pretty easy. Like if you knew what core animation was doing and you were having trouble stitching these things together, I kind of remember it letting you stack them up real nicely.
I was going to say, can you define, or I guess a new way of saying it is, can you unwrap what that means, what property animations means?
So I think you could do things like, change the opacity and translate this from one side of the screen to the other and change the size. So I don't know, like a square becomes less opaque, moves over to the right, and then it grows bigger at the same time. Those ones that are sort of hard to animate all together. You could have sort of done that before with, keyframes, which can be sort of a mess to deal with, or at least, I don't know, I just never got the keyframes. Or you could try doing like timings on like the callbacks stuff.
Does that maybe fall under Marin's previous book where he wrote about UI animations? And he presented it 2 years ago at 360 iDev. Do you remember that?
Or is
that
not
new enough?
If it was 2 years ago, probably not, because they just came out in iOS 10.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I'd have to look up to see what his was, and I'm trying to remember the age of the Core Animation by Tutorials book. But in any case, from what I saw here, if we're even talking about the same thing, I apologize. It was kind of nice that you could say, hey, here's this animation, almost like setting up like a queue, for like an NS operation queue, where like, all right, I want to run this animation, but I also want this one you know, simultaneously. And then at the end, I want this final thing to happen. That's kind of what I remember seeing. And I think it was at work. It might have been some unrelated code review I was looking at. So very, very little tangential experience with that. But it does. So thank you, Greg, for bringing that up, because it does spur sort of the creative juices and says, hey, like, actually, there's some stuff I might want to do in a week or two that would involve something like that. So I'll try researching some of that.
So I'm looking at the documentation right now. It's got some interesting stuff. Like, you can start, pause, resume, and stop animations. Mm-hmm. You can add animation blocks after the original animation start. You can scrub through a paused animation by modifying the fraction complete property. You can change the animation's direction using the is reverse property. And you can modify the timing and duration of a partially complete animation by pausing and then using a continue animation method. That's pretty cool stuff. So a lot of the you know, old vanilla core animation, you would kind of launch it and then you know, wait till it finished, or sometimes you could brute force stop it by just forcing the property, but it was hard to have precise control over some of those animations. This looks like it's greatly improved, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, okay, so that is kind of what I remember seeing in that one code review. I kind of remember that it was largely a nicer way of handling core animation. I don't remember anything in it that you couldn't do with core animation before. It just would have been really hairy to do, and this makes it nice and clean.
Makes it much, yeah.
I think it's the same thing that, I don't know, many years ago, what are we talking about? We're talking 5, maybe 4 years ago. Facebook Pop, if you remember that, was a third-party component from Facebook as a CocoaPod that would do those sorts of things that you just described. I think they might have used it in the Facebook Paper app, and if they didn't, they used it in something else like the animated like button that would push in, spring back out, and then have, like, you know, glitter or something coming out of it. Because I remember using Facebook Pop for that sort of thing, because core animation was difficult to use for very complicated sort of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I suggest too that we also look at Maren's book called iOS Animations by Tutorials. It's been updated for iOS 11 recently.
Oh, so maybe it isn't there.
Yeah, because it's got animatable properties, position size, bounds, frame, center, transformations, which is sort of what you were talking about, Jaime, right?
Yeah, and then way down on chapters 20 and 22 22-23 are new. And one of the first ones that's new is getting started with UI View Property Animator.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Oh, there we go. Okay. This is why it looked familiar. UI View Property Animator View Controller Transitions. That's where I saw it in a code review. It was transitioning from one view controller to another in a custom sort of way.
So which version of the book are you looking at?
I am looking at the one you have in the show notes. It says Platform iOS 11, available for $54.99.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm actually looking at the PDF, but I don't have that version downloaded. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we'll suggest people look at that. We'll follow up tomorrow. We'll follow up next week on this and let you know what we think. So what else we got for Ask MTGC follow-up?
Let's see. We've got one from Dan Beauregard, who says, regarding the iPad 2018 screen protector in no notch, I would hazard a guess that the photo was created from a screenshot which always shows the home bar, but no notch, either faked from an iPhone 10 or real from new iPad. Yeah, this is referencing last week we had that guard or something, screen protector on Amazon, and we said, they're either in the know, they're like, you know, Chinese manufacturing partners, or they're going to have to take the hole punch and punch out a spot for the Touch ID come July.
Yeah, but so like we were saying too, sort of thinking about this, because Dan and I were exchanging a few points on that, they don't really need to have a notch on the iPad because they've got the bezel right around the outside, right? And, I have an iPad right here. Let's have a look at it. Funny where the camera is. Yeah, so the camera on the iPad is in the bezel. I'm looking at my iPad Pro, right? So you've got the home button at the bottom with the Touch ID sensor, and then you've got the camera punch out in the top of the screen. So, but if they were doing sort of a larger screen like it showed in the picture, although why would they put the camera right in the middle of the screen if they have a bezel? Doesn't make sense. Well, I mean, what I'm saying is that's why they wouldn't necessarily need a notch, because if you're going to have Face ID, you know, to open the iPad, you know, you need to have the TrueDepth camera facing forward, right? As well as a camera for regular selfies and stuff, right?
Yeah, so, and I think the space is not quite at a premium on an iPad as it would be on an iPhone, where you want pocketability, right? Like, trust me, I've lived the iPhone 6 Plus and 7 Plus life for a long time, and it still astounds me to this day that I can use the iPhone 10 as a normal pocketable device, yet still feel like I don't really lose that much from the Plus.
So I did some real world tests I don't know if we've mentioned on the show in the past, but, you know, we have a nice big bathtub upstairs, and every now and then I get aches and pains and jump in the bath before I go to bed. And I, because I'm, you know, of the cautious type, I have a couple of Ziploc bags upstairs, and I put my iPhone or whatever I'm using at the time inside a Ziploc bag. And so I put my iPhone 10 in a Ziploc bag the other day, and, you know, every other phone that I've ever had, even the Touch ID sensor works through the Ziploc bag, right? But Face ID didn't work. And I suspect it's because the plastic does something to the infrared array capture, right? So it can't recognize my face. I had to use, you know, I had to use the PIN code like an animal. But so my theory about why this particular guard that we're looking at here has a hole in it is probably for the true depth camera, because it doesn't have anything blocking the feed, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess on the plus side for your scenario, if you ever decide to try to unlock your phone while underwater in like Tahiti or something, you've helped train the Face ID for optical distortions.
Maybe.
I wonder if it's actually using two different light polarizations. The TrueDepth camera is using two different light polarizations, and the plastic actually messes with that.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like I know it does an infrared. Like in when I was doing my research on the secure stuff, you know, in March, there's like a spray of 30,000 dots onto your face, and then I guess it must capture those back again somewhere, right? Mm. And then it makes a 3D model of your face that's how it recognizes who you are. That's why you can't use a mask or photograph or whatever, right? It has to have depth. But I think it also compares that with an image of your face that it takes with another camera or the same camera. I don't know.
Mm, don't know.
But you're right. Maybe it's a double capture kind of scenario, right?
Yeah. But one thing we now do know for sure, Tim, is that you're so addicted to your devices that you can't even stop using them while you're taking a bath.
What else are you going to do in a bath? Like, yeah. I usually go up there and you know, have my Audible book on there and stuff like that. But when you know, getting out of the bath, you inadvertently splash water on the device. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I usually have a nice soothing, you know, book reading to me or something like that while I'm in the tub. All right. And one more, Jaime?
Yes. This one appears to be a chain, but I'll go over the last one. This is Kelly H. Wilkerson, who was chatting with you. This is a little bit of a blast from the past, because this probably sure would have been helpful for you when you were dealing with the backup problems on your iPhone. It's she's referring to a post on a particularly bad early iOS 10 backup encryption bug. And then there's a link there as well. And then another link is her latest updated discussion of corrupt or not compatible during backup and restore. And looking at these links, these do come from 2016 and a new one in 2018. So many, many moons ago, when we got our new devices, we were having different kinds of trouble. I had trouble with my encrypted backup going from my iPhone 7 Plus to my iPhone 10, where like it only sort of half came over. And then yours, Tim, remind me, did you have to start fresh again on yours?
Yeah, so initially I was going from a 6, so I had an encrypted backup, and I was going from a 6 to the iPhone 10, and it just failed right out of the box. I tried it a number of times, and eventually what I did was, because I knew the 6, I had it, you know, I was moving away from it, so the 6 in a sense was a backup, right? I mean, I wasn't getting rid of the phone right away. So I turned off the encryption and made a new backup. I went into where the backups are stored and, you know, changed the name on the folder so that it would think it hadn't done a backup before. So I did a pure backup, unencrypted. And when I did the unencrypted backup, I was able to restore it to the other device, so the new iPhone 10. And that's in keeping, again, with that sort of exploration I was doing into secure ID and all that kind of stuff, is that the hardware, like the way the phone by default works is it encrypts things with a hardware key that's built into the logic board or into the chip, right? So you can't, if you encrypt something with that credential, you can't restore it to another device, which would have another key, right? A different key. So the I guess this is kind of like the private key for the backup won't restore to another device. So I'm not sure if that was by design, or maybe it's different when, I mean, Apple really wants us to move to iCloud for backup, right? They encrypt it on the iCloud as opposed to encrypting it on the device or on a backup drive or whatever. That was my case there. But she's talking about in her blog post here, I think she has a service or something where she talks about Decipher Media is the name of her company, I think. Or she's talking about being able to restore from corrupted backups, not necessarily encrypted backups, right? So she's got a number of tools. So you see she's a developer and she's written all these tools for repairing and deciphering your backups and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, and this is interesting. I bet you ran into one of these. So this is from the 2016 blog post about, you know, person makes an encrypted backup. Backup goes for a bit, fails because there isn't enough space on the hard drive.
Right.
And you try to do the backup again. It succeeds. You move on with your life like a normal person. At that point, the backup is silently broken. I know as you manage the multitude of files for this very show and many other things, I know you and I have talked about your challenges with data storage. So I wouldn't be surprised if you ran into this along the way.
No, I actually back up to a second drive, like I have a 2 terabyte drive that I back up to. But I don't even keep the backup of my phones on my Mac. There was a post on Macworld a while ago about changing. You basically create a symbolic link to your external drive, and then you can back up when iTunes fires up. As long as you have the drive plugged in, iTunes will find your backup folder on the external drive, and it'll back your phones up over there. So I've always had a problem with combined. Like my phone is a 256 gig phone, I think, and my iPad is a 128 gig, and then I have a meager 512 SSD on my MacBook Air, and of course there's not enough room for the OS and Xcode and all of its baggage as well as being able to back up the devices, right? So, and I'm not a fan of iCloud backup. I don't want to keep my stuff in space, you know. I'd rather have it on the drive.
Indeed. Well, thank you to everybody for sending those to us at either at @MTJC_podcast or #AskMTJC on Twitter.
For sure. All right, let's get back to the shoe. So we have some follow-up. Well, follow-up, we talked about t-shirts. I picked up the t-shirts today.
Oh, how'd they come out?
Good. They didn't screw up the thing under the J this time.
Nice.
Yeah. So they look, I'd have to get a computer that's space gray to see how gray they look, but they're pretty close, I think. They're sort of a medium to light gray kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know? Space gray, of course.
Space
right?
gray? Yeah. Space gray is kind of a darker gray, though, than compared to the titanium, right?
You mean the color of the original silverish
MacBooks.
Yeah, they call that silver because we have a couple of those Macs at work. Maybe they're a little lighter than these. Like it's darker than the color of my MacBook Airs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So.
Is it the same color as the new MacBook Pro?
Is that space gray? I think it is, right?
Yeah, the new one. Well, the newer ones.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, no, they look good. Mm-hmm. They're solid too. I sometimes you get gray shirt. Like I'm wearing their Wig Wonder like shirt right now, and it's actually it's a knitted weave where they have like a light fabric, like a white almost and a dark gray. Mm. And so it kind of gets that sort of, you know, half gray, half black kind of look to it. It still looks like gray to your eye. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it close, it's got like white threads in it. This one is a solid, like it's dyed the color you want, right? Sort of thing. Either that or it's made from a dyed fabric probably with the same color thread. So I'm sure Carol could explain it to me much better than I just did. But she's not here and she's not on this podcast. So there you go. So I'll send some down to you, Mark, and I've set up the store for people to purchase them. If you guys want to purchase them, that's fine. But I'll send you some extras to give away.
Okay.
And so I set up a store. I set up the t-shirt on the store. I also set up the store on Teespring too. So if people want to get them printed in the UK, they can. It'll be easier to ship them because they probably have, I don't know what they'll have to pay to ship them from my house to them. But it'll be more anyway.
Alright, send the link.
Oh, it's okay. Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes.
Mm-hmm. That would be perfect because we can talk about it.
Oh, yeah, do that right now.
I mean, as like specifically for, you know, it'll be in the show notes.
Aren't we talking about it now? Yeah.
Okay, so I'm guessing the women's shirt looks exactly like the men's, just cut a little bit differently.
Yeah. And so I had some mediums left over from last year, so it's a good thing I did that. I got ladies large and ladies small. The men's medium is sort of in between the two sizes, so, you know. Like, Tammy likes to wear a men's large, so that's kind of, because she likes them loose, right?
Mm-hmm.
And most of the women want smalls. I had more requests for smalls than I actually had last year, so. I did finally get one to our super fan, Katie. I met her at RW DevCon and give it to her personally. So
yeah, the ones that you gave me, the women's in general shirts went out pretty fast.
Oh yeah,
so I really? Might have like one men's large and one men's extra large, and I can't even remember if they're the same model.
Oh, you mean you
or if it's the different shirts. I have to pull them out of the closet next time I'm going to a meetup. Looking at the space gray, I'm kind of hoping that Apple will come up with some funky new color that we can use next year.
Yeah. Did you, I like the of it now available in space gray because that ties into their keyboard and mouse thing. Did you see the picture I posted on Twitter this afternoon that sort of shows the color?
No, you know what? I didn't.
So here, I'll post in the show notes my tweet so you can see the pictures. If you look at those, that's from MTJC, this tweet. But if you look at the picture of the t-shirt, it's closer to the color.
Okay, got it. Yeah.
Thing. Anyway, so that's our t-shirts are coming. Well, so you have something here about TensorFlow, Jaime?
Yes, this is follow-up to maybe two episodes ago, I think, now, where we talked about the fact that Swift for TensorFlow was going to be open-sourced. It is now open-source, and we'll have that link in the show notes for you, those of you who are driving at home. It is at github.com/TensorFlow/Swift. And
so we were just talking about it going to be? It wasn't available at that point in time when we talked about it a couple weeks ago?
No, at that point, Chris Lattner's video, the one that we had in the show notes 2 weeks ago, I think, or however, it was within the last month for sure. When Google was doing its whole TensorFlow event, I guess. I can't remember if it was like a conference or if it was more like a press release. Whatever it was. In any case, we talked about the fact that it would be open sourced, and now it is. And looking at the GitHub thing here, it's apparently it's a fork of sort of like the official, you know, Apple Swift GitHub project. But as they say right here, I don't know, about midway down the page, it's not intended to remain a long-term fork. As it matures, they want to merge it back upstream into the official Swift.org repositories.
Nice. So do you think, here's where our brains explode. Do you think we'll see Chris Lattner at the keynote at Google I.O.?
At Google I.O.? I could see that.
That's next week, you know?
I could see that, especially if they do something related to, you know, a new tool for TensorFlow that that hooks into Android Studio or something, let's say. You know, and you bring out somebody to say, and it also works in Swift, you know, not only Kotlin and Java, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I went to Google I.O. last year, and there was actually quite a bit about TensorFlow and machine learning in general.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. It also wouldn't surprise me if we didn't see anything, because it's not a, you know, big enough splash from the overall picture as far as Google is concerned. But maybe.
Well, they had that Route 86. What was it, 86? Or that Todd was talking about the last couple of years at both Google I.O.s? Sort of the Mac or the iOS development stuff that Google was putting together?
Indeed. And we did talk about that. That's technically not from the keynote. I think it was part of the session right after.
Okay.
From what I recall of I.O., they don't really have the same structure where, you know, WWDC has the keynote, which is a little bit for developers, but it kind of is more press and average person friendly, and they hint at some of the stuff that will be for developers. And then the platform State of the Union is sort of like the keynote for developers, right? Like, here's all these cool technologies you're going to be able to use. Google's is a little different in that they'll have the keynote. It is all over the place between very developer friendly versus very press and sort of average person friendly, and then they immediately jump into their different tracks and sessions. Something like, you know, using blah 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 on iOS, for example, because their conference is only like 2 or 3 days, so it's a little bit smaller than WWDC in terms of number of days.
Yeah, so this is another story, and this it's interesting, the talk about marzipan and stuff like that we've been having for the last little while. It seems to be that the rumor mill is now saying that if Apple in fact does any kind of cross between AppKit and UIKit, or between macOS and iOS, it's not going to happen this year at WWDC 2018. It might be next year in 2019. Again, who knows? Hard to say, right? Daniel Steinberg had an interesting post today where he talked about he kind of blurred the line between the earnings report, which we'll get into in a few minutes, as well as, you know, where this marzipan thing is going, and who's sort of got the finger on the pulse. It used to be Walt Mossberg that Apple would sort of feed information through, and now it seems to be possibly John Gruber. So it remains to be seen where they'll go with this. But he's thinking that might, you know, Daniel Steinberg postulated that it might be some sort of bridging technology between the two, AppKit and UIKit, that might be something that comes out of this, right? So
yeah, I'm curious to see what other folks think about like the two halves, right? There's the what do we think about the impact on this year's WWDC, because, you know, if this thing moves to 2019, as well as what was rumored before to be a UI refresh that also got moved for separate reasons to 2019, and then the other sort of half of it is this idea of declarative UI,
right? Sorry,
okay, let's take the first half of what I said. It makes me wonder, like, well, what exactly is going to be at WWDC this year, right? Like, we had thought for a while, okay, it's going to be like it's about time for a UI refresh, you know, the iOS 7ification round 2. That got moved to 2019. They're, you know, Apple's really focusing, as we've heard, on, you know, stability, you know, and getting things, you know, some spit and polish cleaned up. And then we heard about marzipan, about, oh, you have some sort of way to make it easier for you to write for macOS and iOS. Oh, that sounds cool. And that wouldn't necessarily require, you know, a UI refresh. You could set the stage now, you know, build your stuff with Marzipan, and then next year, like, if you use standard Marzipan widgets, it seamlessly goes into dark mode or whatever it is that they're going to do for the refresh. With both of those things cut out, I'm sort of wondering, what sort of tricks do they have up their sleeve that will make WWDC exciting? You know, we had ARKit and CoreML, and that was certainly very exciting. What will be the equivalent for this year's is something I'm at a loss. I'm not even sure I can speculate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, maybe they'll do Tab Bar Kit or something like that.
Self-driving car, and everyone who goes will get one free.
That'd be such a bummer for me, because I did put it in. Mark doing donuts, sending us a video.
Did you guys hear the F8 keynote yesterday? They gave away the new low-end VR headset that they've come up with. They gave one to everybody who's at
the F8. Oculus Go? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
So I found Daniel's article here. He was joking about the fact that, you know, like, they might announce that, or somebody in the media will say that Apple's going to have the iPhone 9 will fold out into a flying scooter, you know, and then people will complain later that the stuff they presented didn't really sort of fly, you know? No, where's my flying scooter?
Right.
Anyway, oh, I pasted it in the wrong place. But anyway, it's on the page.
I think the other half that has me interested is this idea of a declarative UI. I'll read here at the bottom of this 9to5 Mac post. Apparently, this is a quote from Mark Gurman. This initiative likely intends to replace nib files with Swift, linked to Interface Builder, which could allow developers to declare their UIs by hand or by using the existing visual tools, much like XAML on Windows.
That's weird.
I think I'm kind of for that. Certainly, if people have listened to the show long enough, there's a new quiz question. How many times in all 193 episodes has Jaime complained about the fact that the backing files for Interface Builder stuff like nibs and storyboards is sort of XML, but it's really not XML because it's XML is the new binary sort of format, as opposed to what you see, let's say, in our sibling ecosystem of Android, where there's layout stuff. Actually, it is legitimate XML that you, like, a human being can read, and if you end up with a conflict, you can merge that in Git, like, very easily, instead of recreating stuff as I've sadly been forced to do, like an animal many moons ago. I feel like something like that would be nice.
They put so much effort into Interface Builder. I don't see that. I mean, like, I get the whole, yes, we can do it all in code, and we used to do it all in code before, blah, 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 but, you know, Mark backed me up on this. They've been putting so much tooling into, you know, auto layout and size classes and different ways of making Interface Builder work with the different sizes and UIs and whatever tools, you know, dynamic types and all that kind of stuff. And what's that other thing? IB definable, the one where you can define custom properties and read them back in Interface Builder. IB designable, yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. You know, they've got all that sort of interplay between Interface Builder and the application. Why would they all of a sudden come up with something that's like all in code? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. I mean, it's possible that you could have all of the IB tools working exactly the same way that, as they do right now, but the underlying files, because Interface Builder does save text files, right, for everything you do. And it's true that they are big and bulky and hard to merge and hard to read and just kind of, you know, there's some ugliness under the wonderfulness that is Interface Builder. And I mean, I don't mean that sarcastically. I mean that seriously. I love Interface Builder, but the files under the hood are kind of nasty. So it's possible that they could redefine that format into something that is more reasonable. And, you know, it's possible that it could even be generating Swift code, which I guess would be, you know, the best of both worlds for people who want to do stuff programmatically. It would actually be kind of cool if you could edit the Swift code underneath and have the changes appear in Interface Builder.
I
don't know if this is doable or if this is what they're talking about, but it would be kind of interesting to see.
Yeah, let's go down that route for a little bit, because I want to, like, the replaced with Swift kind of threw me off until you said something just right now, Mark, that made me say, oh, aha, maybe this is what it is. So let me set the stage. So on the Android side, for Android Studio, again, you know, Android's layout is generally done with this XML stuff, very human readable XML. Like, you can say, this is like a list, and this is a grid, and here's a button, and here's an image, you know, that sort of thing. Android Studio has an Interface Builder-ish sort of thing where side by side you can see the XML, and then you can see how that renders, and you can change one or the other, and you'll see the other updating, which is really cool. So if you extend that based on, I don't know, some generics thing or some sort of, like, I don't know, what do they call it? Domain-specific language sort of thing within Swift that is specific to UI stuff. You know, if you've ever seen, oh my gosh, what is it? I think it's a Facebook project. There's Facebook Bricks or widget or something where you define a layout using code that looks like, it's sort of either JSON-ish or HTML-ish, depending on how you feel about it. You say, oh, okay, this is a grid, and this other thing is a list, and this thing has a button in it, and it anchors to the left, and this one anchors in the center. I wonder if that's what's being talked about here, because all of that would actually be pretty exciting if you could have something that was, you know, a little bit nicer to use, as great as stack views are, if you had something that was just a little bit more, on top of that, to keep size classes and all these other wonderful things related to auto layout and stack views, but made it like that next level. We can make it even simpler and easier to understand what's going on without having to sort of become human compilers to think, okay, what is this going to look like on screen? And bridge that gap between folks who really love using the power of code versus folks who really love using the power of Interface Builder.
It's true. I was going to ask you, though, how many Android developers do you know that use the GUI version of building UI? Most of them I know use code, right? They write their XML. And you can totally write, all of your UI in Objective-C or Swift. It's been done for years. But, if you try and code a button sometime, you'll find that, you need, 15 lines to do what you can do by just dragging a button onto the screen in UI in Interface Builder. So there's so much more economy there. And I'm also thinking, too, there was that product by that guy in Europe, and the same name as a printing press or a plate setter, begins with a C. Anyway, I wonder if he's doing the same sort of thing, because he's created a new sort of UI where you drag and drop elements onto the screen. You could drag an entire table view on, and it's already there, and the cells are all, and you basically can enter in values like you would do in, say, a Keynote or PowerPoint kind of thing, and it would generate the code for you. Didn't really generate anything you could edit in Xcode per se, but you could build apps with it, right? Creo, right? That app Creo, and basically it's like an app. It's like an app for writing apps for iOS, but you don't really. They're not exportable to Xcode or anything like that, right? But he's done the same sort of thing. Maybe he's sort of cracked the nut on what the Interfaces Builder is doing under the hood to build the code to make the UI for your device, right? By having the cooker, like Lego units, so you sort of pop onto the screen and build your UI, right? Same with Paint Code. Paint Code does the same thing, but Paint Code actually outputs the code, right, for your effects, right? Mm-hmm. So I've done a little bit of Mac OS programming, and Mark, have you done any at all, or
a little bit?
Yeah, it's similar, but it's slightly different. Because you have the whole menu thing, and you have mouse events and keyboard events that add a little bit more complexity to it, and I think that the AppKit tools are a little, or sort of just generally writing Mac OS code is much older in a sense than writing for iOS, right? And that's where people complain about AppKit per se, right? That it's not as fluid as writing for iOS, right?
Right. Yeah.
So that's where this Marzipan product is going to come in, is in terms of making a bridging technology, right? Rather than replacing one or the other.
Yeah, I could see that, and even if it covered sort of the 80% case where there are just some things that don't really translate too well between iOS and macOS, like there isn't an equivalent from one to the other. If you had to drop in, to your respective platforms code to deal with that, at least it would get you more of the way there, and it might encourage folks to do more of the cross-platform between macOS and iOS style development, where it feels like there's a ton of Mac apps that I'd love to see on iOS and vice versa, but depending on market and sort of opportunity that people have to try to get through all the cruft of I don't really know this other thing, how do I deal with that? If there was some easier way for them to sort of get their feet sort of wet in both, I think that might be really nice.
Well, one thing that's for sure is if iOS apps are going to run on the Mac, we're going to need more size classes. So I'm hoping for more size classes in this WDC. Been saying that for a while. We just don't have enough to handle all the existing phones.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's funny. There's always sort of been every iteration of Xcode and iOS has always been one or two devices that wasn't really clear. I mean, notwithstanding, you know, iPad being painted with one brush, whether you're in portrait or landscape. But like, I mean, the iPhone 5, when the iPhone 5 came out, we always had a hard time sort of figuring out whether the UI you were designing was going to go. And this is before size classes, right? And I think auto layout was really new and really hard to use. But, you know, I remember having to, you know, try and figure out take the device, UI device, and you figure out what the window size was or the screen size was to determine if you were looking at a 560, is it 568 points high?
Yep.
Device,
yep.
Was an iPhone 5, and then, oh, let's do this, and yeah, as opposed to that. And
yeah, there was no built-in way of detecting whether you were on a, other than looking at the size of the window, there was no built-in way to tell whether you were on a 4-inch device or a 3.75-inch device.
Right, but at the same time, though, they also had that paradigm in UI device, I forget what it's called, what the property is now, but you could always tell between iPhone and iPad. But again, that you had that third sort of, you know, odd sort of iPhone. So you know your app would behave, you'd lay out your app and your code one way if it was iPad, another way if it's iPhone, then specifically if it was iPhone 5, and it was ugly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A lot of work. And then they came out with iOS 7, just to mess this up. So then you had to do 6 and 7 and iPhone and iPad, and then whether it's a 5-inch phone or an iPhone 5 and 4.5 versus 4 screen, yuck.
Yeah, I think to Mark's
Which
point.
Why they need more size classes.
Yeah. To Mark's point, and I think we briefly touched on it one or two episodes ago, it sort of works okay, and it certainly worked, you know, beautifully when they came out. And then you had weird ducks like the Plus model that sort of throws out the window what an iPhone size class would normally be.
Yeah.
The 12.9-inch iPad Pro does the same to an iPad. And then the iPhone 10 is kind of somewhere in between in terms of weirdness of like, well, it's kind of sized like this, but I've got this area I have to worry about and how that will visually look, even if it's sort of structurally okay by using Safe Area.
Yeah, exactly. Anywho, friend of the show, Manoj Pekhadari has also pointed out today, he pointed out an article to me from Mac Rumors talking about, I think it's sort of follow-up to what we were talking about before. It's, again, the folks over at Jamf who are talking to enterprise users about their choices of whether they want Mac or Windows or iOS versus Android or even BlackBerry. And this is sort of goes in stream with that whole sort of, I think it was 2016 keynote by the gentleman from IBM who's in charge of sort of deployment. And so the numbers, the easy numbers are that their TLDR is that 52% of enterprise employees would choose a Mac over a PC, and 75% of those would choose an iOS device over an Android device. And it just goes into not much detail here in this post, but some nice looking charts in terms of, you know, how big that looks in terms of the difference between what people are choosing. And then, of course, I've got a link back to the Jamf website to talk about what people are choosing. So, you know, seeing as I work in enterprise now, it's kind of not surprising to me since I've been working with Mac forever, but it's interesting to see these kind of numbers that this is the way people are kind of choosing which way they want to go, whether it's Mac versus Windows, iOS versus Android.
When given the choice, like
when
the
given
way
the
I
choice,
read this,
yes, yeah.
You know, only 52%, so 58%, or sorry, 48% don't allow them to choose. So that you either gets the Mac or you gets a PC. And then likewise, 51% don't let you choose a mobile device. You get your iPhone or your more likely Android. But when given the choice, it's interesting to see what people do. It feels like the meal ticket sort of thing. If you're at a company event where they do that sort of thing, where, well, you can have this salad with the meal ticket, or you can have this filet mignon. Which one would you like? Well, surprise, surprise, guess which one I choose every time. If it's coming free, I'm going to choose the premium one.
Yeah. Do you think people are choosing that because they think that Mac is premium versus Windows?
I mean, maybe. I don't know. Maybe they really do like those sorts of things. I mean, I'd like to see what these people are, you know, following these cohorts. Like, what are people doing in their own lives? Do they hate Windows 10? Do they feel like, oh man, like I always wanted to learn how to use a Mac, and therefore I'm going to choose a Mac because I have this opportunity that, you know, the company's paying for me to learn how to use one, essentially, rather than me buying my own and then being sort of flustered.
Well, I mean, a lot of the arguments I've had with people over the years of who coming from Windows to Mac is they don't want to give up their tools, or they're used to their sort of, you know, for better, for worse. It's the devil they know, I like to say, right? But it's funny, though, I have to admit, I've always said that, you know, Sony and Lenovo and those sort of higher brand PCs, the ones that cost more, are as well made as Apple tends to be. And they're not, you know, unibody, aluminum block carved devices. But so, I mean, I just got moved over to a Windows 10 device a couple of weeks ago. And so last week I was home sick and So I couldn't, but I didn't bring my managed Mac home, which I could use on the VPN. So I had my Windows 10 machine here. So I spent, 2 days working on Windows 10. And I got to say, it's compared to, all my experiences from Windows 3.1 or 3.4 or what it was, all the way through Windows NT, all through, 98 and 95 and XP. And I don't think I ever worked on Windows 7 very much. Oh, I had Windows 7 up until just recently, but Windows 10 actually is a not bad operating system, finally, compared to what we have on Apple. It's not quite as slick and intuitive and stuff like that, but it doesn't suck as much as it used to, right? I don't know if you guys have played with Windows at all in your lives, but recently or any time like that.
Not recently, but I do have to say that it doesn't suck as much as it used to isn't a ringing endorsement there, Tim.
I wouldn't be working where I'm working now if they hadn't handed me a Mac on day one. If that wasn't, I wouldn't even thought of applying for a job at this place, because if it was, the choice was going to be, you're going to work on a Windows device. It's one of the reasons why I never really sort of thought about working in enterprise, because I figured they'd hand me a PC and I'd be miserable, right? So what I'm saying is that, as much as Windows 10 and this Lenovo device I've got is fairly recent. It's even got a touch screen on it, which I'm not so sure about. But I wouldn't say it's pleasant. It's not as nice. I mean, I can do tons more on a Mac than I can on a Windows device. But given that I was doing my job, as it were, and I wasn't writing code. It was, basically doing email and looking up stuff on the wiki and stuff like that, and communicating with people on Link and things like that, and dialing into meetings and things. It could have been, the Windows 7 machine I had up until then was clunky and fuggly and whatever, right? So Windows 10 isn't horrible. It's horrible as it used to be. Anyway, moving on. This is an interesting one. I don't know if you guys saw this article. It's one of the blog posts from Matt Triple T Thompson. Benchmarking Codable. What's interesting, though, I mean, I was more interested in the numbers than the way it works, but he was talking about, if you're pulling in a lot of data, and in this case here, he's pulling in airport information in the example he's got here, and talking about how if you're pulling in one record or 10 records or 100 records is one thing, but if you're bringing in 10,000 records, the time it takes to, first of all, the size you're dealing with in terms of your API call. I mean, it doesn't sound like much, but a 3.2 megabyte file, adds size to your application as well as, how much memory you're using, and also time to deal with that, right? And in the bottom piece, if you skim down to the bottom of the article, it talks about execution time. And it turns out JSON serialization versus codable. Codable takes, almost a quarter longer to work than JSON and serialization. But I don't think that's a good reason to not look at codable. I think codable is by itself is a much slicker way to work with JSON. I don't know if you guys have done that much.
It's more than a quarter longer from what I'm seeing. I'm looking at the table at the bottom.
Maybe two-thirds, I guess, yeah.
From 382 to 603.
It's math, man.
Yeah, no, that's something like 60% slower. Well,
no.
Yeah.
Anywho, but again, that's with a large data set, right? So
yeah. Well, look at 30 versus 51. That's almost double. Not quite almost double, but
I would say two-thirds roughly. That's sort of visually how it looks to me. Mind you, 382 is almost 400 to 600. Yeah, so it's 6 to 4. How about that? Or 5 to 3.
For the example you guys are talking about, the 10,000 JSON items, I did the math. It is about 57%.
57, okay.
Difference. So winging it at about 60 is about right. It's close enough, right? Horseshoes and hand grenades sort of thing. It's a very interesting article. I definitely love seeing the NS hipster style writing back again. It's mm-hmm. very well written. It's very pleasant to read. It's not a very long read, which is good. And I think it comes to a very pragmatic conclusion of, we've said before in the show, there is a price to magic. It's just as true in Dungeons and Dragons as it is in software. And in this case, it seems to me that for most cases, that price isn't that bad, and it is totally worth the developer time that is saved, in not having to write that stuff or, build a sorcery template or something. But yet, it's still very pragmatic in that it says, look, do some benchmarking and see if your particular case, maybe JSON serialization is the right route for you because you need that performance boost.
Right. Yeah, it could also be that, by sticking to codable too, you're going to see the benefits coming from future versions of the OS products and hardware from Apple, you know, I'm sure they must realize that there's a performance hit here, and you would think in future they would address it. Whereas if you go down to some third-party route or whatever, you run into all those other dependencies as well, right? So.
Yeah, and I also think like we'll start to see tons of performance gains when Swift hits the ABI stability.
Right, yeah.
Because at that point, they'll know that, okay, look, there's not going to be crazy changes. All right, string is a collection. No, it's not. It's totally a collection now again. You know, stuff that would be hard to invest in a lot of performance tuning. I imagine we'll see that really, really happen when ABI stability hits in some future iteration of Swift, hopefully soon. And you're right. I think stuff like mm-hmm. Codable will probably be one of the big areas that the folks at Apple will really, really hunker down on and say, okay, this is something that's really common. How can we squeeze performance out of it?
Now, Mark, what do you got for the Apple earnings talk?
So as of today, when we're recording this on Wednesday, so the Apple released their earnings yesterday on Tuesday. And contrary to what the pundits were saying, Apple is not doomed. In fact, it turns out that things are pretty good. The earnings were, earnings per share, Apple beat the estimates. They were $2.73 versus $2.67, which was the analyst consensus per share. Revenue was $61.1 billion versus $60.82 billion. Now, it is true that iPhone unit sales were down compared to estimates. They were 52.2 million versus 52.54 million, which is, you know, not a huge amount. The guidance is in a range of $51.5 billion to $53.5 billion versus the consensus was $51.61 billion, which is right in line, if not even better. So yeah, overall, it was a great report, and Apple's stock has responded as of today. It was up 6 or 7% today. Partially, that's because Apple also increased their dividend, and mm-hmm. they're doing a $100 billion stock buyback, which of course, if Apple's buying back shares, it may generally makes the price of the stock go up because of supply and demand. So it's looking pretty good for Apple shareholders right now. There's some argument that some people will make that, well, share buybacks are a little bit artificial, and you know, companies sometimes do that to cover up that business isn't so good, but I'm not really sure that's the case in this case. It may have more to do with the amount of overseas money that Apple had that they were able to repatriate because of some changes in the tax laws here, but whatever the source, Apple is doing very well by shareholders, and overall, the company seems to be doing as well as ever. So things are good.
Yep.
Yeah, there's some interesting numbers in here for me, and actually some that were not in this article, but I'd certainly heard people talking about it. So let's talk about the iPhone X. You know, we certainly talked about, you know, gloom and doom from supply chain, you know, estimates and stuff. And even though they didn't hit the estimate in terms of the average selling price for the iPhone, so I think Wall Street's was a little high, a little optimistic. It's certainly not gloom and doom, because you say, well, yeah, you know, the average selling price of an iPhone was $728. That's slightly below the $742 that Wall Street wanted. But the thing that's missing for this article is something I read elsewhere, which is, you know, comparing against year over year quarters, it's up from like $639. Because remember, Apple sells, of course, $649 US phones. That's sort of the base price for the newest models. But let's not forget, they also have a very popular iPhone SE that people like, and that starts at $349. So leaning towards $728, you know, almost $100 more than the $649, what you would expect for brand new phones, implies heavily, like really heavily, the iPhone X is drawing in a ton of revenue and in enough numbers to sway the average.
Or the higher memory versions of the 8 and the 8 Plus. Those will skew higher too.
Yes, those certainly help as well. Yes, no doubt. I think I saw...
Right, it's interesting what Walt Mossberg was saying in his tweet here, that he pointed out that in the last two quarters, Apple has garnered nearly $100 billion in revenues just from the iPhone alone. And by comparison, Microsoft in an entire year did $90 billion last year in 2017. So the iPhone sales is doing really, really well still. So, and he did say at some point, or somebody said at some point, that the iPhone X, maybe it was in Daniel Sleinberg's post, that the iPhone X did really, really well, surprisingly. Most people were, you know, we were saying the last couple of weeks with all the cutbacks on manufacturing that they're thinking that, or people are thinking outside of Apple, obviously, are thinking that the iPhone X isn't doing as well as was expected. But in fact, it's done really well.
Yeah, and those manufacturing issues could could be just normal cycles. They could be that they overbuilt and have a lot of inventory, or they could be just gearing up for the next one.
Right.
So we're cutting back on manufacturing of the current version.
Yeah, the iPhone 10G or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think 9 is going to be the logical name, I think. I mean, the 10 comes from the 10th anniversary, and I think we figured out before that it's, what, the 13th or 14th phone, actually, in reality, right?
Yeah, but if they call the next one 9, what do they do next year?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't have a new iPhone 10.
Right. Well, they could call it 10 with a 1-0 to really throw people off. Then the people will be really scratching their head about, you know, this phone.
The people at The Verge will explode into a fiery rage if they have an iPhone 1010 and also have a X10.
Or maybe they'll call next year's model the iPhone X, just to confuse everyone.
Just to really make it...
Yeah, or they do with the iPad 3, they'll just call it the new iPad, or new iPhone. Call it the new iPhone.
Well, you know, by next year, maybe it'll be time to change the naming convention. Certainly possible.
iPhone Lisa.
Or start naming them after cats.
Yeah.
A couple other things in this CNBC article. Gloom and doom over the HomePod as well. We talked about precisely how many were they selling in that one really successful store in Idaho. It says here that Apple's other products revenue was $3.9 billion, higher than the Wall Street account estimate of $3.7 billion, which I don't know what to say there, because it's one of those mysterious areas that's really hard to read, you know, the stuff they lump into other. Very similarly, apparently Tim Cook said that wearables like the Apple Watch and AirPods were up almost 50%. But without disclosing what that actual number is, right? So we really can't figure out. But anecdotally, that seems about right. I think AirPods a little bit less frequently. I see them out sort of just randomly in the street versus, you know, at tech conferences or tech meetups or something. But for sure, Apple Watch is something I notice on folks, that just random folks. So I think it's really finding sort of that sweet spot of success.
Sorry, were you saying you see AirPods rarely?
No, I see them, but probably missed. Stated that I see them more frequently, you know, as time goes on, but probably a little bit less frequently than I do Apple Watches.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. Because I'm seeing a lot of them now these days. They seem to be cropping up all over the place.
Yeah. I think the word of mouth probably helps there. You know, people always wonder, well, what's the comfort like? And you have a friend you trust, you try them out and see. And also, if you have a friend you trust and you're like, doesn't it fall out when you run? No, man, I ran the Boston Marathon. It's totally fine. Still got them good.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's easier to see here. They also said they sold 9.1 million iPads and 4 million Mac computers. So.
And services was up as well. It was 9.19 billion compared to the expected 8.39 billion. So continuing that trend that services is becoming a bigger and bigger part of Apple's business.
Yeah. Doomed, telling you. Yeah. What are we going to do? We have to learn how to use Windows 10.
Yeah. I hear it doesn't suck as much as it used to.
Yeah, have it on good authority, right?
Yeah.
All right. Oh, and just a quick one here on we were talking last week about Marin mentioned folklore.org, which is the blog by I forgot his name now. Andy Mac guy. You know the guy from the original Mac. Anyway, there's a new post here just from a couple of days ago, actually, written by Bill Atkinson, who I met at WWDC a couple of years ago. Actually, guessed back in 2014, I guess. He posted a story about his time at Apple and how he was thankful to Jeff Raskin for convincing him to go and talk to Steve Jobs and drop out of school and go work for Apple and you know, write all the fabulous stuff that he wrote, the menus and stuff like that, as well as it. And then when Steve left to go to work to start Next, he stayed around to do HyperCard. I think you probably remember HyperCard, right, Mark?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, it's Andy Hertzfeld is the person's name I was trying to remember. Interesting sort of story here. And it's interesting that folklore.org is still producing fresh content. So this is just like as of a week ago. Because he talks about maybe 40 years ago, he started at Apple on April 27th. So I think it's the day he published this story.
You know, the styling of this site is very web 1.0-ish. It's very sort of...
Yeah, it's not gray,
charming.
Though.
No, yeah, true. It's very charming. But I think if it was in a more modern format, I believe, without a doubt, the pull quote for the article would be, inspired by a mind-expanding LSD journey in 1985, I designed the HyperCard authoring system that enabled non-programmers to make their own interactive media.
I was just about to comment on that same line.
Yeah. They don't quite write software the same way anymore, do they?
We have no way of knowing, Tim, but if, look, we are absolutely not advocating for mind-altering substances on the show. Just let that be very clear. However, it is interesting that you get stuff like the Beatles' work, or if you enjoy Alice in Wonderland and Lewis Carroll's work, guess what? There were mind-altering substances involved in the creation of those. Mm-hmm. Not saying it's a path of success, certainly not saying people should do it, because certainly there are very, very terrible consequences for those. But the fact of the matter is, stuff just happens, you know? Mm-hmm. And apparently, no comment, HyperCard happened right, because of LSD.
I can neither confirm nor deny. Can I take the fifth?
You know, as a last note there, depending on what you consider mind-altering substances, I can guarantee that just about every developer or, you
caffeine
know,
close is, to like 90%. Sure.
Exactly, exactly. I enjoy a bit of coffee in the morning every day. It gets me going. I feel more productive. So if you were to remove that, would I still be as effective? I don't know. I have terrible sleeping habits, so probably not.
Well, I used to drink a lot of coffee back in the day, and I'm down to like maybe one or two coffee cups of coffee today. In fact, lately I've been drinking tea more than coffee, but another story altogether. But you know, you can get over it eventually, mm-hmm. next time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All righty then. So where's my notes? So you have something here about Microsoft. Who are they? Oh wait, before we do that, we have a book winner.
We do. All the submissions are in for the quiz we mentioned from last week's episode. We had Aaron Todorov on the show. We were raffling off via the quiz, you know, your answers to the quiz. We gave you an entry into the randomly selected drawing, and we've mm-hmm. selected a winner of I Should Be a Better Host, and I Should Have the Book Prepared Here. It is the Realm Realm by Tutorials, roughly, is the name of the book, the one we talked about last week.
hang on, I get my Google form here. I want to read some of the answers that the winner gave us, which is pretty good. So anyway, who's the winner there, Jaime?
The winner is a friend of the show, Adam Armstrong. Ooh. Adam Armstrong, if you listen to this episode, congrats. You have won the copy there, and we'll figure out how to get that to you. But yes, congratulations on that. And Tim, you said you had answers there that...
So I just wanted to go through some of the questions we had here just real quick. I got to go to responses. Yeah, so, we know his name already. He already gave us that. But so what animals were mentioned on the show in episode 192? So apparently, And correct this. I'm not sure about this one. This is a long answer. He said elephant, gazelle, birds, vapor. I don't know if vapor is an animal. Tadpole, nematode, fish, octopus, sea anemone, unicorns, raptors, bruins, cubs, bears, seahawks, dogs, chickens, and a rat. I don't remember talking about an elephant. Do you remember talking about an elephant?
Elephant in the room is probably where that came from.
Elephant in the room. Mm. Okay.
And then, yeah, and raptors and bruins was the hockey reference, of course.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this caused a discussion on the edges of animal. Like vapor is an interesting one because it's in reference to the tadpole salamander looking thing that's on the Ray Winderlich book for Vapor by Tutorials, I think it is. And
but viper is a snake.
Did he mention octopus?
No.
We definitely talked about octopus.
Yeah, Chordata. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mark took one. A little bit of interest in Chordata being represented by an octopus.
By an octopus.
I recall. And I'm kind of curious on the boundaries of animal, if whether Seahawks count, since there isn't, like, it's not like a real thing. You can't go find a Pacific Northwest Seahawk, you know.
Really?
In Elliott Bay. I'd have to look this up to see it is, because I'm not from Seattle thing. Originally.
But seagulls, does that not count?
It's kind of like a seagull mixed with native art from the Salish tribe, if I'm not mistaken. Really, really cool art, native art. And it's just kind of a made-up animal. It's a mythical animal, is what I'm getting at. And they do have, like an actual hawk that's at the games, like the mascot, but that's not a Seahawk, right? It's not like a thing that you'll see in a taxonomy of the animal kingdom.
Sure. What t-shirt was Jaime wearing during the show? And it was, of course, the Realm World Tour t-shirt. Got that one right. Who edited the Xcode book that we mentioned on episode 182? And that, of course, was the new Xcode Treasures book. And it was edited by Tammy Coron, sometimes host, sometimes guest on this show. I'm going to come back to this one. What did Mark say was 8080 based last week, and he mentioned Texas Instruments, and I think Greg sort of said it was a particular model you were talking about, TRS-80.
Well, it's a TRS-80 is the one I was talking about.
Okay, yeah.
Here's another trivia question. What does TRS stand for?
I don't know.
No idea.
We'll let the fans answer that one. Well, nothing for answering it, by the way. And then how many times did Tim say sorry on the show? Well, technically, so in the little bit we were talking about, the Canadian committee thing. I said sorry three times, but technically I played that at the beginning of the episode and in the stream. So that's six times. And I did say sorry one more time during the show. So I think it's actually seven times. So
yeah, this caused a controversy in the counting too, as to precisely what that number was.
Yeah. Well, it's either three, it's either four or seven. So depending on how you slice it. Right.
Yeah. So we won't take away the book, but Texas Instruments is wrong.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
8080?
So, well, the 8080 was the chip made by Intel, and the TRS-80, hence my trivia question, stands for Tandy Radio Shack.
Oh.
It was made by Radio Shack, which was acquired by Tandy.
Wow.
Not Texas Instruments.
Yeah, I would have guessed like a Tandy. Never would have guessed Tandy Radio Shack.
Didn't we say or didn't I say Texas Instruments on the show?
Well, for those of us of a certain age, back in the day, Radio Shack was actually a real thing where people wanted to go and hang out at and buy things and do things.
There was even a Radio Shack Moog synthesizer. Did you know that?
I didn't know that, but it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, so they're pretty rare it was sort of an entry level Moog, if you want to call it that, right? But yeah, it was made by Moog, but it was branded for Radio Shack. Cool, eh? All right. So congratulations, Adam. I think Greg said he met him last year at WWDC, right? So
yes, I believe that was the case.
All right. I was going to say, have you talk about Microsoft, the Microsoft store there, Jaime?
Yeah, I guess this technically counts as follow-up as well, because I'm fairly certain we talked about the fact that at Microsoft's Build conference in 2017, it was announced that iTunes was going to be available in the Microsoft store. And it is, like, a week before the next 2018 edition of Microsoft Build. So technically still true that they delivered when they talk about it on the stage, I'm sure. Apparently, it is a hefty install at 477 megabytes, but it's basically the iTunes you know and love.
But hasn't iTunes always been available on Windows? What am I missing?
So that's different. So you're right that it has been available on Windows for a very long time, and Steve Jobs got very grumpy about it back in the day. This is in the Microsoft Store. Think of it like the App Store equivalent or the Mac App Store. So as they note here in this article from Ars Technica, because it is a store app, it's installed and updated via the Windows Store Updater, not Apple's installer and updater.
Oh, I see, right.
So apparently it doesn't, try to do iCloud stuff or any sorts of things. I'm vaguely aware of something called Centennial, a technology on Microsoft's side that makes it, I think, simple enough to have your normal Windows app that would normally be installed wrapped up in some sort of abstraction that allows it to be usable from the Microsoft Store. Again, thinking of it as the rough equivalent of a Mac App Store. And I think Centennial apps and store apps sort of fall under that same sort of thing. Like, if I were to go download a Mac app, like right off of some company's website, there's Gatekeeper and other things, but it's not the same as the sandboxing restrictions that you would get for apps that are downloaded from the store. I believe it's the same sort of relationship here with the Microsoft Store.
So it's not like downloading an EXE from the store where you have to choose the place on your drive where it's going to install and all that kind of stuff. Is it sort of like a installer packaged, if you will? And does it fall under app review as well with Microsoft?
Presumably. I believe there is some sort of review, but I don't recall where on the spectrum it falls between sort of Google's Android store that's predominantly automated, and then if there's something weird, they have an actual human being look at it, or Apple's sort of implementation where it's largely human beings and a little bit of automation. I would guess that Microsoft probably falls somewhere in the middle.
Right. Well, that's good. Just a quick one here. I didn't even know this was happening. I kind of wondered what was happening with the MacBook Air, but apparently there's a 13-inch MacBook Air MacBook Air model. I guess the 13-inch is, the 11 is probably gone, but apparently the 13-inch is due for a refresh. I mean, I'm running a 2013 MacBook Air, so I mean, it's been a long time. We've been waiting for this device. If it was going to come, I didn't even know it was coming, but apparently it is coming, and it's the announcement here is that it's delayed till the second half of 2018, but hey, better late than never is all I got to say. So I was kind of wondering about that because, I'm really sold on Touch ID now. I don't know if I would even go to a MacBook Air at this point. I might go to like a MacBook Pro 13, right?
Well, what if it included Touch ID?
Yeah, Yeah, that would be great, right? Because then I get the advantage of having a light to carry computer, which I don't really carry around much anymore. But I do carry it back and forth from my desk to my couch. You know, so it's a long way to go to carry a heavy Mac, right?
Touch ID is so 2 years ago though. I want a Mac that has Face ID now.
Right.
There you go.
Right. Good point.
Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. You just sit down at your desk, pop open the cover, and boom, you're in.
Yeah. You know, I kind of wonder about that too. Because what was I thinking about? I was thinking about the iPad when we were talking about Dan Beauregard a couple of days ago. You know, do you really want? Well, I don't know. I guess you just look at your iPad and it opens, or you look at your Mac and it opens. I get that, but I'm not so sure about like purchasing things on the App Store, like that kind of thing. Like, I guess that's why we have to double click the button on the phone to validate purchases, right?
Right. So you double tap the space bar or something.
Yeah, or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's take a little bit of time to pre-Snark, a device that does not even exist yet. So the mythical laptop that has Face ID on it. So what are the immediate problems that come to my mind? Problems here in air quotes. These are first world, extreme first world problems. What will people be complaining about on podcasts?
Not available in the space gray.
That could be one. I was thinking more two scenarios. One is the people who always have their laptop closed when connected to a monitor. So I don't know, for space reasons, or they put it in one of those like vertical silo sort of case holders, right? Does it work for them? The next one is for people like me. I'm not going to complain about it because it doesn't really impact my life, but I have my primary monitor directly in front of me and then the secondary screen a little bit off to my right at about, 3 o'clock on a clock coordinate system. That's where my laptop is. And boy, oh boy, you're going to hear people complain, oh, every time I want to log in, I have to turn about 3 inches to my right or left, look at it, and then I can look at the screen in the center. So there you go. Here's your pre-snark for the 2018 rumored Face ID enabled app.
On the people who keep it closed one, but not that last one, because you only have to look at it once, and then you can set it to not go to sleep for as long as you want. So I don't see that one as an issue.
Well, there's also the other side of the coin is that this is not going to have a Retina display, because the current MacBook doesn't have a Retina display, right? And then if that's the case, where's Mark's 5K monitor, right?
Sure.
Oh, and mind you, I guess you can go third party and get a 5K monitor, right, Mark? Remember you were talking about having an Apple branded one?
Was I talking about that? I mean, at my office, I have the LG one, which is the official, officially supported one.
I think before the LG came out, you were wondering where the 4K or 5K monitor was from Apple. But
well, I was, I was wondering when for a long time, the successor to the Thunderbolt display was going to come out. And it never did, of course.
The end of this article, it says, the key feature for the model is a speculated resolution jump, moving to a moving from 1440 by 900 in the current gen to a Retina level 2560 by 1600 LG produced screen, possibly produced by LG. Like, that does not make sense.
This is what on the back.
Do you think it's made by LG? This LG produced screen?
The LG produced screen, possibly produced by LG.
I got distracted by this article I'm reading about how since Apple released 11.3.1, they're now no longer signing older versions of the OS. But I'm trying to wonder how far back they're not signing. Usually it's one or two versions back, right?
I thought it was pretty, like, I think there was a grace period, but I don't remember them having a version, even a minor version, back signed. Am I mistaken on that?
I
thought it was like,
you know,
maybe like a month or two that they'll still have the old one signed, but then it's like, all right, everything was good, cut it off.
Yeah, like 11.2, I would think, would be something like that would be signed back, right?
Interesting. Yeah, I'm looking at that same article, and it does specifically say that they're not code signing 11.3 because they're trying to get people to update to 3.1. It doesn't necessarily, although this would be a little odd, but it doesn't necessarily mean that 11.2 has been turned off. It's possible that there was something specifically about 11.3 that they're trying to get people off of.
Oh, maybe there's a bug in it or something.
Maybe, yeah.
Right.
Or security issue or something like that.
Yeah. I do recall something about, I think it was a fast fix, right? Like a hot fix getting this dot one. I vaguely remember something.
The displays, right? The third party displays.
Right. That's what it was. Yeah. Yes. If you replaced your display, it was something about it wasn't working properly and it had something to do with the OS. So they did a real quick turnaround, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess the follow-up section of the show is now over. We can move right on to our picks, right?
It was the all follow-up. follow-up show.
Yeah, all follow-up. In fact, this stuff is almost follow-up, too. So what do you got for this, Jaime?
Yeah, this is a relatively new site by Paul Hudson. You may know him from Hacking with Swift. Also has whatsnewinswift.com. And it's pretty neat because let's say you haven't been keeping up date with the latest things between, let's say, version 4 and version 4.1 of Swift. Or let's say, maybe a pretty realistic example for our audience is you take on a new project and you say, oh my gosh, this is in Swift 2.2. What is different between Swift 2.2 and Swift 4.1? And you can choose those little drop downs. Let's say it goes from Swift 1, 1.1, 1.2, 2, 2.1, 2.2, 3, 3.1, 4, 4.1, and includes actual 4.2. That's pretty good. We can do that too. And you can see the difference, like, oh, okay, well, new in Swift 3, all function parameters have labels unless you request otherwise. And you can omit needless words. Yeah, so it gives you some blast from the past or perhaps some practicality of, what the heck is going on here. Because sometimes I've noticed the migrator doesn't always work so well when you haven't migrated along with every step. It sort of is incremental. It's not like, oh, take the Swift 1.0 and convert it into 4.2. So you need to do some manual surgery there to get your projects up and running. I think this might be a good resource for that.
Didn't we talk about this was not this site we talked about what's new in Swift 4.1 recently?
It might have very well been something very similar because I was thinking this had already existed.
Did Greg do this?
Maybe it was, wow, did he really? Did I re-pick a pick like a week later?
Can you believe that you might have done that?
Dude, when was the last time Greg was
scrolling back here? It'd be funny if it was you that did it, actually.
Well, if it was Greg, there'll be a tweet about it very soon.
Maybe there will
be. There you go, Greg. If you're looking for something to correct this on, there's a softball waiting right there, waiting to be crushed out of the park.
Yeah. And going back to 186, I don't see it here, but I vaguely remember we talked about Paul Hudson before. What's new in Swift 3.0?
So we have talked about various individual articles, and for all I know, maybe this takes from that same database and presents it in a nicer fashion.
Yeah, maybe that's the thing, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was in his tweet, because I'm looking here. It's mentioned in a tweet of his that I brought up.
It's so difficult, in this multimedia world. It's like, was that in the show? Was that in our Slack? Was it on Twitter? Was it an email?
Back a ways. This is going back to March, so no, can't be it. No, maybe you're right. Maybe okay. We'll give it to you until we hear from Greg.
Cool.
All yours. Oh, I see. So the changes in the different versions. Doesn't Apple have a site like this?
We have talked about what is different between different versions of Xcode or different versions of iOS.
Maybe. Yeah.
You can do the little drop down and see like, looks like they added something to core animation, that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, this does look
We've also talked about other sites that did like textual diffs of the App Store review guidelines, so you could see precisely what changed instead of vaguely remembering.
Yeah, so going from 4 to 4.1. Oh, yeah, this is cool. No, there was something similar like this, but I thought it was from Apple or something.
Yeah, Apple documentation does have something kind of similar, and that's what you were just talking about, where it's color-coded, what's new.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. This could be handy, because actually we were just talking today or yesterday about what's the difference between Swift 4 and 4.1 as we're moving soon ourselves, right? This will come in handy. Cool. All right. Pretty tabs open on my computer. So this one definitely is follow-up, but and so it's interesting. The question came up about giving attribution in your code, like who you're supposed to know, how do you give attribution in your app and that kind of stuff, right? So one of the team members at the Raven Nordic Slack there, Jano Mittelfeldt, who's currently in Germany, I believe, sent over tldrlegal.com, and it lists off some of the most popular open source licenses that are out there, such as our favorites like the MIT license or the Apache license or the GNU license or the BSD license. And so, for instance, if you click on the MIT license, it tells you in a sort of quick what you can do with it, what you cannot do with it, and what you must do. Like, for instance, in that case, you can use it for commercial use, you can modify, you can distribute, you can sublicense, and you can use it for private use. You cannot hold them liable for anything that you do in your code or they've done in their code, but you must include a copyright and you must include a license with the code. So I'm not sure. So it's a sort of handy tool to basically use TLDR legal to find out what's going on. Of course, we have to throw in the disclaimer, Jaime.
we are not lawyers. Presumably neither are the people who are doing this, or at least you should find out. I don't know.
It's for entertainment purposes only.
Yeah, exactly. Because I don't know how accurate these are, again, because I'm not a lawyer, but off the cuff looking at, like, you know, what does the MIT license require, and what does the GPL version 3 require? The can, cannot, and must columns look reasonably reflective of that. But, of course, the devil is always in the details, and that's why we have lawyers.
Right. Well, this one is maintained by Kevin Wang, this particular one here, and it doesn't say that he's the one who made TLDR legal. It doesn't say whether he's a lawyer or not either, so you can either say, well, Kevin said it was okay, or whatever. And it's been looked, this particular license has been looked at 458,000 times, and it's got 81 hearts on it. But interesting thing, if you're looking for this, by the way, in my case, since you asked, I'm sure you're asking, Mr. Listener, I actually have a lawyer that I would contact and ask this kind of stuff and pay him, you know, $300 or whatever to get an opinion. Or I would just ask Mark and Jaime what they do. And so what do you, because we've talked about the MIT licensing and I think the BSD licensing before, right? So how do you guys go about, how would you go about, like, does that just mean you put the license in the code base with it? Like you pack it in with the bundle, or do you expose it somewhere in, say, a settings panel or an about page, if you're using third-party libraries in your app, that is?
Yeah, well, I try not to use third-party libraries as much as possible.
Yeah, I knew that was coming,
But, of course, you know, general rule of thumb is, you know, for something like an iOS app, you probably want to look for something that has an MIT license or an Apache license versus, say, a GNU license, because the problem with the GNU license is you have to disclose the source code, and with the MIT license, you don't have to. So that's kind of the general rule of thumb, and yes, you do have to include, one advantage of doing something where you do disclose the source code is that you can just include the license file in the source code. You don't necessarily, well, again, I'm not a lawyer, but I think if you do that, you don't necessarily have to disclose it in your app. Whereas if you aren't disclosing the source code, you do have to show the license in the app, or at least make it available. You don't necessarily have to give the full license file, but maybe you have a link to it or something like that. You for sure have to acknowledge it somewhere.
Sure. I mean, if you do put it in the bundle, I guess, you know, technically someone could unzip the IPA and see the file is there, right? And maybe if it's a plain text, they can read it or strings it or whatever, right?
I'm not sure that that's enough, though, to satisfy. Again, I'm not a lawyer, but I don't know if just putting it in the bundle, which is not readily accessible to anyone, I'm not sure that's enough to comply.
Yeah, you would put it in an about screen or something like that, or
put it on like an about or a settings or something screen, and maybe have a link or a button where you can actually bring up the license file in the app, or just have it be a link to some website where the license is posted, something like that.
Right, Hammond, what were you going to say?
I think Margaret's right. I'm not a lawyer, but even if it technically met the letter of the license and therefore the law here, generally untested law, mind you, like there's still a lot of Wild West stuff going on and precedents to be set in the world of open source licensing. But I would guess that the weakest sort of thing you could do is include it as part of the bundle that somebody could, if they have knowledge, pull stuff out, because you have technically distributed it to them. But I could see a reasonable judge saying, that's not cool, because the average person isn't going to know how to do that. And you might be meeting the letter, but not really the spirit and intent of the license.
Right.
So yeah, I think Mark's right. I don't know. I've seen a couple different ways, and I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know if one is legally more sound than the other. Where folks will have like an about screen within the app itself. So you go to like the settings, you know, junk drawer of Doom, and you find your way into legal licenses and stuff. And it says, okay, tap here, and you've got this enormous scrolling list of every license for every, you know, thing that they've included in their third party stuff. And then I've also seen that sort of same sort of mechanism, but not within the app itself, but over sort of banished over to the settings app land. So it's included as part of the app itself, right? Like the stuff that goes into the settings app is pulled out from your bundle, to display stuff. So again, I don't know what the legal precedence is for this. I would guess in my uneducated non-lawyer sense that banishing it to the settings app is probably a little bit weaker legally, but still feels better than merely just dumping it into the bundle.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I know I've seen the license sometimes appears in a CocoaPod. If you're downloading CocoaPods, I've seen them in there as well. But
and there is a CocoaPod that will generate license type stuff for you for all the CocoaPods you've included. I have
really?
No clue.
Where does that go? Where does that? Yeah, that was actually the answer the guy was looking for. Do you know what the name of that one is, by any chance?
No, I honestly don't.
Oh, cool.
And I don't know what happens for like Carthage stuff. I don't know if there's a Carthage oriented solution for this.
Yeah, but presumably, so what do you think that CocoaPod would do? It just kind of gathers them all together in one place, kind of thing, or?
Yeah, I think, you know, if, and this is another thing where it gets sort of tricky and dangerous with CocoaPods in that I'd say 9 out of 10 pods out there include like an actual legitimate license file. I don't remember if it's required as part of the CocoaPod spec, and maybe this has changed over time.
Right.
But I'm reasonably certain I've seen CocoaPods projects out there that don't have a license file, or they have a license file and it's 0 bytes because it's empty. And so therefore you wouldn't really know or have anything to display. But if you do, it does. The CocoaPod thing I'm thinking of was something that would run at build time and go grab, you know, because it can read your pod file just as well as CocoaPods itself can, and go grab all the license files for, you know, the 10 CocoaPods you're using in your project. You don't have to go manually add these things to your files somewhere.
Making a note of that here. Yeah. All righty, cool. Do you have a pick, Mark?
I do have a pick. My pick is a book that is actually just came out. It's pretty new that I picked up on a whim, and I'm actually really, really happy about it. It's called Classic Computer Science Problems in Swift, and it's written by a guy named David Kopeck, who apparently is a professor in Vermont, and it's actually a real nice book. So what I was expecting was kind of a cookbook of, you know, Swift implementations of just some, well, classic computer science problems, and it is that, but it's even more than that, because it's also kind of a tutorial on algorithms at the same time. So nice. it has just a whole huge set of problems of all different types, and full disclosure, I'm only, you know, about 20% through, so I haven't read the whole thing, but so far I'm pretty happy with what I've seen. And it starts off with kind of simple stuff and gets even more complicated, and it does give Swift implementations for all sorts of problems, but it also gives kind of the idea behind the problem and what algorithm is used to solve it, and you know, it goes into some tricks to speed it up. In some cases, it'll give sort of it starts off with the classic, yeah, the very first one is the classic calculating a Fibonacci sequence, which is, you know, just 0, 1, 1, 3, is that 1, 1, 2, 3, where you take the last two numbers, you add them together, and that's the next one. So it kind of explains how you can do that very naturally using a recursive type of algorithm, but you quickly get into problems where the depths get so large that you're limited relatively quickly in how high of a sequence you can calculate. So then it talks about, well, you can use memoization to get around that, or do an iterative approach. So it's nice, you know. So it's not only did it give you an implementation, but it actually gives you a couple of different implementations and explains the trade-offs and the advantages of both. And that's just the first problem. So there's a large, I don't know exactly how many, but there's a whole lot of them, and they're really bite-sized, you know. So you can read, they're usually like one or two pages each. Maybe the more complicated ones get longer, but I haven't gotten that far in the book yet. So you can just read them and, you know, depending on how fast you read and how experienced you are, you know, maybe 10 minutes or maybe an hour, and digest it and type in the code if you want, or download the code and play with it. So yeah, real nice book. Pretty happy with it.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking at the table of contents on Amazon's Look Inside. Some real classics in there. Fibonacci, as you mentioned, Towers of Hanoi.
Yep.
The 8 Queens problem. There's an Australian map coloring one that I'm kind of curious what that is, because I recall a map coloring problem. I don't remember it having the Australian prefix to it.
I have the book open in front of me. I can find that one. Let's see. That's chapter 3.
I've also heard that problem, I think, referred to as like a Dutch bridge problem. It's the Dutch have a lot of bridges.
So I don't think it's anything specific about Australia here. It's the problem, as he poses it, is imagine you have a map of Australia that you want to color by state/territory. No two adjacent regions should share a color. Can you color the
regions with just three different colors. So I think the Australia part is just a convenient example because that's a case that is very easily done using these three colors.
Okay. Because I might be reaching way too far back. And if you're studying for an exam in computer science, I apologize because I'm failing you at the moment. So don't use my answer on the test. I could have sworn there was like some sort of mathematical proof around, you know, what's the minimum number of colors you would need for coloring some arbitrary map so they would never touch. And it was like four or five.
Right. So the Australia case is a slightly simpler one that you can get away with using three. So I think that's what he's referring to there. It's not the general case of any possible map.
Right. It's a won't hurt your brain and get the concept across at the same time. Certainly. So this sounds cool because it not only will you learn there, but they certainly seem to have real applicability to the kinds of problems you're generally going to get for interview whiteboarding coding type things.
Yep. And the nice thing is it's a brand new book. So it's all on Swift 4.1.
I was going to say, because I've been looking for books like this for a little while. I even picked up a couple of books on algorithms recently. So this is right up my alley.
Yeah. Another nice thing that I've noticed already, even though I'm not too far into it, is that he definitely uses idiomatic Swift. This is clearly not a case where the author originally wrote the book in some other language and then just, changed the code to Swift to sell it to more people. Because his Swift code is pretty nice and uses a lot of the Swift tricks that that we all know and love.
Cool.
Yep.
I'm kind of curious on, this is David Kopeck is the author. I clicked on his name on Amazon and wanted to see what other books he has. I'm very curious on this person's background because besides this classic computer science problems in Swift, he's also got Dart for absolute beginners, Dart being the JavaScript-ish replacement from Google, and co-author with Christopher Pileggi, Artificial Intelligence and Problem Solving. That's quite a variety of books there.
Yeah. Well, he's a professor, it looks like, in Burlington, Vermont. So pretty close to you, Tim.
You should go down there and give
him a visit sometime.
Yep. Actually, a small, funny story about Burlington, Vermont. You won't believe this, but I bought my first PHP book in Burlington, Vermont. I saw this book online and I was thinking about buying it and saw it in a Barnes & Noble or something like that. We stayed over in Burlington one night on the way back from down east from Boston or whatever. Yep, small world. They have a ferry there across the, I think there's like a Lake Champlain or something like that down there.
Lake Champlain,
And the fastest way across it is to take the ferry. So
I've been there once too. Was there on a business trip there? IBM has a big, or used to have a big facility there.
Yeah, not a small place. It's pretty big. Yeah. I mean, cities go right in the middle of ski country, right?
Yeah, I did go skiing for a day while I was there.
I wasn't there quite then, but yeah. Cool. All right. Well, I guess that's it for the week. And how do people find you if they want to find you on the interwebs?
I'm on Twitter as @devofthehair.
All right, and Mark, if people want to get in touch with you?
Mark R. It's not soft.com.
Oh, Mark R. Clever.
It's always
fun. All right, and as usual, I am Tim Mitra, TimMitra on the Twitcher machine is the easiest way to get a hold of me. And like that, we'll talk to you guys next week. Bye.
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 This concludes another intriguing, insightful, and inquisitive episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. I'm friend of the show and sometimes host, Greg Heo. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at @mtjc_podcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskMTJC. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/mtjc. You can find all the details on how to help us out on our website. That's mtjc.fm/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time, eh?
By the way, honey, what was that trick you were telling us about how to get rid of all the tabs on your phone? You force touch on the, in Safari, on the phone. Do you remember the trick?
Oh, that's a good question. Let me pull up my phone.
I thought you force touch on the X or something like that.
But to force close them all?
Yeah.
Let me see. Whoops. Oh, I accidentally closed one I didn't want to close.
You force touch, your long press on the done, I think. Yeah.
Oh, I see. In my case, I have, like a blank mobile Safari page, and it has the, I don't know what this button is called. It's in the lower right hand corner. It looks like two sheets of paper, one stacked behind the other.
Yep.
You can long press on that, and I have an option to close all 11 tabs, close this tab, make a new private tab, or make a new tab.
Oh, really cool. Yeah, but if you also go into that mode and you long press on the done, you can close all the tabs, as opposed to just, because you only go into those ones and you hit the X to close each one at a time, right?
Yeah. And pro tip for those of you who didn't listen to that episode, if you did like I just did and accidentally closed a tab, you can long press on the plus and get the recently closed tabs look. So I'll bring that back up.
Oh, so you can, does that work on the all or just on the one if you do the one?
I don't even want to pretend that I'm going to take the chance of closing all 11 tabs. So we'll follow up. So once I get through all this reading material.
Well, to give an example here, I have 229 tabs open, so.
In Mobile Safari?
Yeah.
Oh man, that's making me twitchy. I can't deal with that.
I'll send you a screenshot, even better. All right, so another follow-up piece we have here. So here's an interesting fact that we talked about this before, that Apple now has podcast statistics for podcasters, right? We talked about that before. Well, I've taken a look at some of the numbers, and they don't jive with anything like what we see in our regular feeds. And I think that's because of Apple's only capturing information from people who actually opt in to be to have their information shared with Apple. And also, I think they're only capturing listeners who are using the podcast app, right? Or iTunes on your Mac, right? But or maybe a Safari browser as well. Basically official Apple products. And so it seems to me that when I look at the amount of time that people spend listening to the podcast, they probably listen to most of it up until we do the sign off, and then they might bail. So a lot of them may not get the quality material that we put into the after show. That said, on last week's after show, we talked about The Simpsons, specifically the problem with Apu and the furor that's a raising. And so it was an interview that was published in The Star with Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons, about I think it's the 30th anniversary that's coming up. They've done 636 episodes, and I believe that in the next couple of weeks we'll have the 30th. So then that puts them in the same range with Gunsmoke, which was another show that was on forever, it seemed. But they asked him specifically about a number of things, about like how he feels about, the longevity of The Simpsons and that kind of stuff. But they asked us pointedly about the question is, do you have any thoughts on the criticism of Apu as a stereotype? And his answer was, not really. I'm proud of what we do on the show. And I think it's a time in our culture where people love to pretend they're offended, which is a viable answer, in my opinion. As I said last week, I think it's kind of part of what the whole Simpsons is all about. I don't think anybody is a safe subject on that show. They don't skirt around issues with other parts of the show. So why would they do that? So any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's so tough because I want to be, mindful of folks who are, legitimately offended. I don't want to belittle that by any means. But I do think he's right in that we, in like a 24/7, well, I guess it used to be 24/7, media coverage, like press coverage. I think it's now 24/7 people on the street sort of coverage, with something like Twitter, Facebook, what have you, where I do see a trend where it's sort of like, oh, you should be offended by this thing. I'm totally offended. And it's like, are you really? I'm looking at your post history, and I could guess you probably wouldn't be offended by this. I think you're looking for clickbait.
I'm offended by potty humor, but I've laughed at potty jokes before, so.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Mea culpa.
Right.
And watched South Park and not run away screaming.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. Yeah. I I know people who are offended by this stuff, and they make the conscious choice not to participate in it or support it and whatever, and more power to them. I happen to live with one of them, right? But, it's humor. It's meant to be funny. If it offends people in today's day and age, perhaps it should be dealt with. But you know, it hasn't bothered people for, well, maybe it bothered some people for, you know, the last little while, but I think I sort of relate a story that, you know, when I first came along, I think I was the only Indian kid in an entire school, and, you know, so that was kind of a tough place to be. So, or not even Indian, half Indian at that, right? So not even fully a card-carrying member, right? So I love the part at the end of this article where he talks about, is there anything left on your Simpsons accomplishment list? And he says we need our own full theme park. We've got some rides. We need some rides with the Krusty Burger at Universal Parks, but we need a 600-foot tall statue of Homer at the center of a theme park, and you can eat dinner in his head. So
I would go.
Yeah. Not taking himself too seriously is my point. Okay. I'll have to put a disclaimer on
the thing. Looks like you lost a little weight in this picture.
Sorry, what?
Oh, yeah. You lost a little weight.
No, the one below there. I got all my tattoos done, too.
Yeah.
And my nose piercings and stuff.
Does he even know the piercing?
Yeah, you have to zoom in on it. Yeah, you can't see this picture. I was working. This is a high. This is a low res version of that picture. So
that thin, ripped sort of look.
Actually, that's interesting. You can tell it's a mocked up photo because it's a V neck.
Yes. No, I thought about that. And I probably should fix it in Photoshop, but, you know, I figured. Hello. You know,
who cares?
The shirt beside it shows what it's like, right? That's the color of the one on Teespring, actually. But if you look at the photograph below, you can sort of see the shade of gray.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I like how the logo deforms on the model there.
Yeah,
well, that like it's not totally flat, right? It actually tries to semi look like it's going over the folds.
Well, so that's my Photoshop trick because
is that an optical illusion or is that real?
That's an optical illusion. It's actually square.
Yeah. Oh, is it? Okay, wow. It looked like the coloration was doing that. I was like, oh, that's pretty neat. I didn't know that they did that.
Well, no. So that's my skill in Photoshop. So what I do is I take I do a mask around the t-shirt and I make it neutral. I throw the saturation out to make the t-shirt gray, right? And then I place the artwork over top and it's square, but it looks odd. It looks like it's fake, right? So then I take the shirt again with all the folds and textures in it, and I make a layer on top of in Photoshop, and then I use like a filter to just affect to apply some shadow to the white, you know, and then it looks like it's actually on the t-shirt, but it's not. If you took out a measurement, or if you could zoom in on this, which you can't because it's too small, but you'd see that it's actually square. It wouldn't be square on a body. It would be actually distorted, right?
Back where it gives a link, does it also say more than just Code Podcast or just the link?
No, it just says It just says mtjc@.fm, just like it did 2 years ago.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Do you think for next time maybe it would make sense to write out what it is so people know?
No. What do you think, Jaime?
Yeah, it's tricky because the fact that it's not written out causes a lot of folks to ask me, what is that?
Well, exactly.
Right? So there is some mystery there. With that said, we should consider next year's model and see, okay, is there like a style where we actually do spell it out?
Yeah. Right? Well, it's kind of like a bumper sticker, like on the back of your car, right? That's how I look at it. Like my intention is that, and maybe it is flawed in that you put the website there and if people are interested, they'll go, hey, I wonder what that website is, and then punch it in, and then they find out what it is, and they go, oh, this is so disappointing. Sorry, I followed up on that.
They should put like a QR code on the back or something next year.
Yeah, maybe.
Or we do an A/B test. We have two different versions with a slightly different link.
Right.
One says what it is, one doesn't, and see which one gets hit more.
And we put a Facebook pixel on, and we see which one gets better A/B testing, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, print a Facebook pixel onto the thing. Yeah, no, well, the whole idea of QR code.
That will only tell us how popular it is in Russia if we put a Facebook on it.
That's, or China. They like them over there.
Well, yeah.
Anyway, yeah, because it was all those out. Because remember last year they added QR codes to Facebook? Or, Twitter. I'm thinking Twitter. Sorry, Facebook.
Before we get some tweets correcting us, I earlier said that the Intel 8080 was the chip in the TRS-80.
Yeah.
It's not exactly true. It was actually the Zilog Z80, which was a ripoff of the Intel 8080.
Oh, okay.
Set the record straight.
Yeah, Tim, please put this as like the very last thing in the episode, like the after show after show.
Why?
So we can troll Greg.
Yeah.
He claims, I'm on to you. I'm going to wait till I finish the episode before I tweet. He's like, are you, Mr. Hio? Are you going to wait till the very last final second? Let's find out. So please help us with this experiment, Tim.
We'll have that tweet typed and be about ready to hit enter, and then we'll pull it back.
Yeah, he probably listens on Overcast at 2x the speed, so he gets his full reading in there. So you know what? I'm just looking at the header on his Twitter account. He's got the Oakland Bridge on there again. What is it about? Isn't it like the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge is supposed to be the one that people are supposed to put in there as the ubiquitous picture of bridges.
Yeah. So the Golden Gate Bridge is the famous one, although the Oakland Bridge is actually the more used one, interestingly enough, because it goes to the East Bay, which is way more populated than the North Bay, which is where the Golden Gate goes.
Yeah.
But I don't know. That kind of fits with Greg's sense of humor, I think, to use the off the beaten path one, the not so commonly used one.
Oh, I guess. Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. I've never actually been across it myself. But the BART goes across there now, doesn't it?
It doesn't go across the bridge. It actually goes through a tube under the bay.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Through a tunnel. But this bridge is actually brand new. It was the old bridge was kind of a disaster. And in fact, pieces of it collapsed in the big 1989 earthquake, killing some people. So it was kind of a mess. When I say new, it's been a few years now. They spent a good, probably a decade rebuilding the whole eastern span of the bridge, and they finished it 2 or 3 years ago.
Right.
So it's a whole brand new one. Earthquake safe.
Is it earthquake safe?
That's why they built it. Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Well, I mean, it depends on how big the earthquake is, of course, but it's meant to be safe against any foreseeable earthquake, knock on wood. You know, it's always possible that we'll get the super big one that'll destroy everything, but hopefully not.
The super big one.
The big one. When both the Hayward Faults and the San Andreas Faults both slip at the same time and it takes up the whole Bay Area.
Really?
That's the one where California will, what's left of California will be an island, and you'll have Nevada beachfront property.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.